From the Quackalope Network headquarters, this is the Weekly Quack with Board Game Co., your ultimate source for what's happening around the board game pond. In this week's installment, we take a trip to Spirit Island, decide to slay the Spire, and embark on Darwin's journey to the Galapagos.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Weekly Quack. I am one of your hosts, Jan Begas. No, I'm reading the wrong text. I am not Jan Begas. I am Alexander, let's be frank, Jingle Jangle, the Muskrat. Who put the Muskrat in there? Sender Radcliffe III from North Undershire, 0.63, Bordy McBoardface, Jackson Harris, ASR3, and this is the Weekly Quack.
Hello, everybody. This is Jan, and that's Jesse. How are you doing today, guys?
I'm a duck.
You're a duck and a quackalope. How was your New Year's festivities, everyone?
Well, my New Year's was delightful. I managed to play games with a close friend of mine and, you know, hang out and play some games. Delightful game of Galaxy Trucker that went exactly like I expected it to.
Yeah. My New Year's was terrible. I ended up playing probably 18, maybe 20 hours worth of games with a very close friend and lost tragically to Galaxy Trucker.
But you did do fairly well in all the other ones. I mean, except for that game of Root.
Oh, are we talking about each other? Should we give the audience a little bit of context? That we've spent the entire last weekend together?
Did you actually?
Yeah, it was what? Pretty fun. I traveled down to Kentucky, hung out with Jesse for a bit, played some games, filmed some videos, did a live Q&A, which was amazingly fun. I really enjoyed those. I enjoy interacting.
It did really well.
It was by far my best Q&A until to date. It's still growing, still doing well. It's a fun little thing in ISS Vanguard where we got to talk about, well, whatever people wanted to talk about, really. And then from there, we just played games. Root, Primal, we played Galaxy Truckers, a whole bunch of stuff, Spirit Island. There's a whole host of games that we got to the table.
Yeah, it was a good, did a full interview with Alex, a lot of great conversations. It was a really productive weekend. I'm already sad that it's over, and I am looking forward to the next one, despite the fact that my stance still remains, Galaxy Trucker is a miserable game, and even more so when played with Alex.
Why was I not invited to this?
You were invited.
Where was I?
You have an open, frequent invitation to Jesse's house, I assume. I'm not Jesse, but I'm just assuming.
I didn't see any mention that you guys would be getting together during New Year's. I'm so sad. Where was I, Jesse?
I believe you were in Puerto Rico.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I was in Puerto Rico.
Oh, that would do it. But with that.
Yeah, that makes it more complicated,
all that said,
buddy.
Thank you so much for joining us on today's show. And for those who are new to the Weekly Quack, welcome. This is a board game variety podcast organized into three main segments. Shelf or Sell, where we debate whether a game is entering or leaving our collections. The Medley Minute, where we talk about quick little musing, news, all that stuff. And On the Radar, where we discuss upcoming games, Kickstarters, retail, maybe late pledges, keeping things mixed up and always interesting. And at the end of every show, we take some time to go through audience feedback and questions. But before we get going, if you like what you hear, be sure to leave us, Jesse, is it a 1-star or a 5-star rating they're supposed to leave? Because I'm
1-star
review. Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts from. Yep. And with that, Jan Begas, I want to like call you the third, but that's my thing. Jan Begas, what are you bringing to Shelf or Sell? I've never heard of that game.
So, Alex, today I am bringing in a very teensy tiny minute game, because since I've been traveling,
why did we start with Jan? He always brings in these weird apps. I'm bringing in a game that's gonna offend people, Alex.
No, you don't. Okay, go ahead, Jan. Okay. Go ahead.
So we're starting off with me because it's the smallest game. We can talk about it really quick, dedicate a few minutes to it, and then we can go into the heavier titles, which I'm assuming both of you are bringing based on that amazing weekend that you two had and I wasn't able to be a part of.
Also, as we know from One Night Ultimate Werewolf, good things come in small packages.
Sure. Today, I am bringing in Spicy, a very simple bluffing and trick-taking game by Hildebar Games. Have either of you heard of this one?
I have heard of it. I have seen it. It looks intriguing. That's roughly where my knowledge ends.
Solid nope from me, Jan. Solid nope from me.
Look, okay. We might not be used to talking about travel-sized games, but they are important.
No, Jan, this is a bluffing game. I am already interested in hearing more about it.
Yeah, I already think you're getting rid of it.
Wow, Jesse, why is that? Is it because of the box? Is it what arbitrary means have you decided on that?
Because of the fact that it's best with four or five or six players, and I just don't see you hitting those numbers right now and wondering when you're going to play it next.
Seems reasonable. He's also bad at bluffing, so there's that standard standard little gem.
Am I bad at bluffing? Really? This is news to me.
I can hear
it
in your voice right now. Mm. It's not news to you.
Okay. Well, for those people listening that might want to know a little bit about this game, let me go ahead and give a quick summary. Spicy is a simple bluffing card game for 2 to 6 players. In it, cards are played face down into a central pile that must follow two simple rules. All cards must be of the same spice, aka color. There's 3 colors in this game, and they have to be played in ascending order, starting from 1 all the way up to 10. And once you reach 10, you reset with another color. However, because all the cards are placed down, players are able to bluff on their turn and break these rules, opening themselves up to be challenged by other players. Whenever a player is challenged on their bluff, the challenger has a key decision to make. Are they going to challenge you on the color of the card, or are they going to challenge you on the number of the card played? This allows for a lot of tactical and intelligent card play, but above all, paying close attention to your opponent's behaviors and what they actually have in their hand, because all cards have an allotted amount of cards they have in the deck. For example, there's 3 of every single number, so you're able to count a little bit as the game goes along. And when the game ends, the player with the most points accrued by collecting cards and trophies — trophies are particular cards in the center of the board — win the game. And that is Spicy in a nutshell.
That actually sounds really interesting. It reminds me a bit of Cockroach Poker with its own little twist on how things play out. I tend to like bluffing games in general. I tend to like the quick, accessible thing they provide. I am curious how this actually plays, but conceptually it sounds pretty interesting. And you're still getting rid of it.
Hey, Alex, this is a mealworm.
I'm not sure it is, but give me 1 second. Wait, I'm gonna look at it and pass it on. Jan, it's not a mealworm. Okay. It's a muskrat.
Do we have any questions for me before I give my final determination on Spicy?
Sure. When was the last time you played this?
I played this about, I would say 3 days ago.
3 days ago.
How four many people ago. Did you play it with?
I played it with 4.
Mm.
And is that a muskrat?
Yes, it is a muskrat.
Oh,
you
no,
got it right,
he's
Jesse.
Right. It was
no.
a mealworm. It was a mealworm.
It was a mealworm.
I lied. There's no muskrats in Cockroach Poker. That would be a weird thing. You know what? Honestly, it's interesting because I'm leaning towards the idea. Well, do you like... I never like priming too far in this conversation, but do you like other bluffing games in general?
Yes.
Okay, you're getting rid of this one. It doesn't hold up. It's pretty good. It's interesting. It's intriguing, but it doesn't hold up to other games in this genre.
Okay, so I am keeping Spicy because it is an accessible, simple, and fun game to get to the table that I can explain in probably 2 to 3 minutes with a single deck of cards and get going ASAP. And it does include a little bit of that trick-taking and mystery that I like in this genre of games.
Excellent. I'm adding it to my wish list.
Yep. It's not a Lady Blug. He is bluffing. He is getting rid of it.
No, I'm being genuine. So here's the thing. I've gone on a binge lately and have started to buy all the classic trick-taking games, or small box games that I could ideally play in less than 2 to 3 minutes with anybody and explain in 2 to 3 minutes. And I also have, so right now I'm showing Cockroach Poker to the camera, I'm showing Skulls to the camera, and in the back there, I think I have, it's like a pirate game about bluffing as well, I don't remember, but it's a pretty popular one as well. I'm trying to go through all of them. So far, out of the trick-taking genre that I've played, I have The Crew, and now I have Spicy, which both I thoroughly enjoyed a lot. The Crew gives that sense of camaraderie as you're going through these missions with more and more complexity being added. However, there's a little bit of rules overhead that makes it a little bit tougher to get to the table once you're getting to the higher degrees of that. But Spicy is just that. You play a card face down and you just have to do your best to try and decipher, is it the right time to play this card? Which of these two things am I going to lie about? Am I going to lie about the color, or am I going to lie about the number? Because one of the cool things about this game is that when you're placing down cards on the table, you never lie about the color change, because obviously from 1 to 10, everything has to be in a particular suit. So obviously you're never going to say, oh, I'm playing a green 5 when the entire stack is, red reds, right?
Yeah.
But when you actually start playing the game, you can start mixing up those numbers. So for example, in the ascending order, I could say the first card that was played is a 1 red. Cool. I'm going to go ahead and then play a 7 blue. But nobody knows that I'm playing that that blue card. I am playing a 7 because it's an ascending order, so, which is fine. So when somebody comes and challenges me, if they decide to go for the number instead, I still win that bluff and I get all the cards. So it's this really interesting kind of like push your luck element to it, because as the stack starts getting higher and higher, somebody's going to get a ridiculous amount of points and you're basically just gifting them. So I feel that this game incentivizes people to constantly challenge each other and stop each other in their tracks. Even if you get it wrong, the repercussions aren't that huge. The
yeah,
way that,
that
you
that whole
win
aspect
this game
is very much what appeals to me about the game, but the whole that aspect of being able to always have a room to play with, something different that you don't necessarily have to be a straight up lie or truth. It's a halfway thing. And that's really
exactly.
is what's interesting to me.
And I feel that kind of invites a little bit more of the sense of perception and observation. For example, just the fact that if every player has been playing their cards or the correct card in nanoseconds and one person takes a single second more than normal, they could either, you know, that's already something to think about. So it starts giving different layers of challenge and of understanding of the table that I find really nice for such a basic and simple game as this is. However, there is a little bit of variability in there. You can add, I think it's some rules variants that are through cards that can start changing up the game and making it a little bit more complex. But still, I thought it was really fun. I will give you an update once I play all the other ones that I have.
Yeah, I'm intrigued.
I mean, the only small box game I have room for in my life is Llama, but, you know, each to their own.
So, Jesse, you sound like you have something intriguing. So my question to you is, should I go next or do you want to go next?
I'll take it. There's no way yours is more interesting than mine. And at this point, we need to keep the audience's attention.
Stop it. People like travel size games too, Jesse.
I'm intrigued. I'm
I
getting my hands
do,
on spicy
Jen.
As a result of this conversation.
I think it's fun.
I bet they do. Mm-hmm. Alex, I'm excited for an episode or two down the road where you bring in Spicy and we can determine what you're doing with it. I should probably actually order a copy as well. Let's all get copies of Spicy and we'll all bring it in. That being said, today I'm bringing in a game that has been on my I need to play list for an extended period of time. I believe I bought a copy a year and a half ago. I've had it in shrink for probably that entire duration, and I just recently had a chance to play Spirit Island for the very first time.
I will withdraw.
Now, for any of you who are not familiar with what Spirit Island is, this is going to be a complex, asymmetric, cooperative game all about using various deities on this island to protect the indigenous population as colonizers start coming onto the land. I think we were playing against the Europeans, Alex. Is that correct?
The United Kingdom? So, I don't know who it was.
The United Kingdom went straight for a variant, huh? So the United Kingdom was flooding onto the shores, and we were doing our very best to support the local tribes and use our powers of wind and rain and growth and fire to wreak devastation and frighten them back into the boats that they came from. The game is going to be primarily structured around individual asymmetric player boards that scale in abilities and complexity throughout the course of the game, and then also a deck of cards with a mild built bit of deck building throughout the course of the game as you're upgrading and leveling the personality or character profile of your spirit. These powers and abilities really scale in a interesting and very, very, I'd say, unified way. The challenge that's presented on the board is answered, at least in my experience, with the amount of powers you have or the opportunity for powers and abilities in your hand in a way that makes it feel like by the end of the game, the threat is greater than you could bear. But then the ability for you to overcome and destroy that threat is also pretty magnificent if you can figure out the puzzle that is in front of you on the table. This game is loved as a cooperative game because it limits player alpha player. It limits player quarterbacking, and it also is loved as a solo game because of the puzzle and complexity that exists in it. The degree of challenge as you increase variants, increase spirits, and use expansions, I'd say, is probably endless.
Yeah, that's
wow,
about right.
I can't believe you're not keeping this.
And I'll hold off before we get into your what you're doing and whatnot. I'll wait till Jan locks in his answer before I comment, because I played this game with you. And so I may or may not have some insight because you are also a troll.
Sure, that's fair.
But I will say as well, something that's worth noting is the Branch and Claw is an expansion that by many is considered essential And yet I haven't even felt the need to play with it at all yet. I'm looking forward to breaking that out one day.
Why is it considered
essential? I do not know. I've heard multiple times the idea that they consider Branch and Claw to be, to make Spirit Island a complete game, that without it, it's they took something away. Hmm. And they did come out at the same time. It was in the original Kickstarter for the game, so it was not something released after the fact. That being said, for myself, speaking for myself alone, Spirit Island is a game that I genuinely love, even having never tried the Branch and Claw expansion, nor the Jagged Earth expansion, which I have myself as well.
So let's swing this over to Jan and see how he's going to engage with this. Jan, by the way, this is a cockroach.
Jan, what is do you it, think? Are you passing or it, are you... You can pass it to me. Take a look.
Okay. Okay. I'm going to pass. I'm going to pass. And it is a cockroach.
What are your thoughts, Jan?
I think
Jan?
It's a cockroach.
any questions?
Anything along those sure. lines? I just can't believe you're going to sell it. So first of all, the reason why I'm getting to that decision is it's a gut feeling just based on the way that you read this out and just like your facial expressions. I didn't see any spark as I usually do when you really like a game. For example, like Great Western Trail. I'm not sensing that. I could be completely
Jen,
off.
I don't
in that
know
sense.
If I would look into that. It's been a long time since I saw the spark in Jesse's eyes.
Ow, Jesse.
It's literally been 2 days since we played games together, Alex.
He means way before that, Jesse. Way before that. First question. So it seems like you've played this only two player. Is that correct?
That is correct.
I have played this only two player.
Okay, you only played this two player. Did you play straight up with any variants, or did you just play the vanilla experience?
Well, you already
it sounds
know
like
that.
You included you just included the United, yeah,
we
United
didn't,
Kingdom.
We did not include any of the scenarios, but we did include the United Kingdom.
Interesting. Yes. So you went a little bit harder than it usually is then.
Correct. A drop harder. Not like there's like six levels of difficulty plus variants. We didn't go all the way up that chain, but we wanted to go
a little past
the basic vanilla.
I guess the last question that I would ask is, but this would kind of start bleeding into your own actual opinions about the game, which is the thematic ties within this and how you felt that it kind of attached to the gameplay and the narrative within the game. I would have thought that you would have loved this one. I'm surprised that my initial feeling is that you're going to sell it. So I don't really have any deeper...
Lock in your choice, Jen. Lock in your choice.
No. He's going to sell it. I just don't know why yet. Not really. Jesse, take it
away. Was that in fact a cockroach?
I believe is a cockroach. I'm going to go with yes.
Well, look at the card.
And
look at the card.
It is a cockroach. Jan, back to you.
It is absolutely a cockroach. Jan, of course I'm keeping this game.
Oh, okay.
Are you kidding me? Now, here's the thing. There is a caveat. I am intimidated as all get out about this game. I mean, the idea of playing this as you scale complexity with multiple players or a solo mode, God forbid, the amount of management Alex was doing to make sure that we even had a chance to go up against these, the invaders on our island. And you're going to have to watch the full gameplay to get a sense of what's happening. But Alex really pulled punches, or not really pulled punches, really, really leveraged his abilities while I was playing a support role throughout the course of the game and watching things unfold.
I don't know if I agree with that at all. I mean, I will certainly say that I took care of the management of the game part of things, but that you were essential in what was happening in that game. I think what you're confusing is that I had a more offensive spirit and you had a more defensive spirit. That just means we are playing our roles.
And I did not mind. I did not mind. I played defensive appropriately. I really enjoyed covering the land with green and spreading it throughout. But this game is every bit as intriguing and good as people say, but also way more intimidating than I mean, I am more scared of this game now than I was before I started playing this game.
Is it rules-wise, Jesse? Like, what is intimidating about it exactly?
So, there is so much to manage. There's so much little abilities and variants and how you sequence things. And as a solo player who doesn't always do the best at keeping track of all the little moving parts and pieces of the puzzle, it's just a lot to do. There's a lot of math you're doing in your head as you're working through things. I enjoyed playing with Alex because he was doing a lot of that for me.
Now, out of curiosity, Jesse, what is, in your opinion, the heaviest game you've ever played? Aside from this one.
Mage Knight, right?
I mean, Kingdom Death, Mage Knight, TI, those would be the three of the
Mage
top.
Knight. So the reason I'm curious is because, for instance, using Mage Knight as a reference point, Mage Knight is coming in at a, let me see over here, it's a 4.31 weight rating. Spirit Island comes in at a 4.01, meaning it's in that class. It's definitely high
really?
Up there. It crosses that line.
Sure.
Now, for me, what I find interesting is I don't consider... Spirit Island is a game that has a very high weight rating, but it tends to be a little easier to get to the table once you've played that cycle once or twice.
I don't disagree with you. I think this one is easy enough to get to the table. I brought it with me to Florida. I'm down here in Florida right now.
Such a good choice.
You know, celebrating my birthday. I have it down here with me. I plan to play it solo. I'm hoping to experience a little bit more and then do some content on the channel. But the reality of it is, while I think I can table it easier, I think running and manipulating it and actually playing it for like effectively, accurately, is really going
to
be
difficult. I have a few pieces of advice as how to run it solo for the first time until you're comfortable with it. And the first is going to be, don't play with any of the variants at all. Just play core on its own. Because while the game...
That is my initial. I'm going to play base game,
it's
base
game. It's not so much even the difficulty aspect. It's just one less thing to be aware of and to manage. Number two is going to be that when you look at the spirits, they all have a degree of how they stack on the back, how offensive, how defensive they are. Try to avoid picking a... Because when you play solo, you can play two-handed, three-handed. You can play six-handed if you want. Yep. I recommend playing, for at least initially, I recommend playing a single spirit.
Sure.
And to that end, you're going to want to pick one that has a little bit more offensive capabilities. They don't have to be all offensive, but it's going to be slightly harder to win with a defensive spirit on your own without having any other support going on. And then the third and final tip is, you have my number.
Okay.
Call me if you need any help.
I hear you. That 2 a.m. call, you're going to be really frustrated by.
Oh, dear Lord,
by.
Jesse.
I also, though, you have to keep in mind when I play games, but I now have an open invitation, and I'd like to extend that invitation to anyone listening to this podcast. if you need help with Spirit Island specifically, Alex is always available. All that being said, sorry, Alex.
Are we going to share the number? 202-555-3498, right? That's Alex's number?
That's it.
Yeah. You can go ahead and call that anytime.
Some poor guy in the 202 area code is in for a whole bunch of calls.
All that being said, I mean, at this point, we're going to have to put it on a shirt. I still think that playing multiple spirits is going to be really, really hard for me. Now, it doesn't mean it's going to be hard for anyone, but I think for me, I am much more intrigued about one spirit versus one island versus one scenario. Even as I ramp up that complexity, I am less intrigued about managing multiple decks, building multiple decks, sequencing multiple abilities. I think the combination, the cooperative experience of layering, I loved being able to work with you and cooperate. I see no enjoyment from myself, the way I play games, in that process.
That's where I saw your critique coming from, or not even critique, just your worry. I immediately associated that with just like synergies in this game and how difficult those synergies might be to interpolate as you're in the thick of it.
Yeah. And finally, I'll note, just as an aside, I've been playing this game solo for quite some time now, and I have never felt the need to pull out two spirits. I have been enjoying going through spirit at a time, just one at a time, just
that
going through them, because
genuinely good to know. I mean, honestly, because I was worried. I'm keeping this game. I'm excited about this game, but it comes with a big caveat of, I think this game may have a 30% or a 40% window where I do not want to play it. High player counts, multiple spirits. I think it's wrong for
me. I don't disagree.
And before we go, Jesse, I wanted to give you a chance to kind of talk about mechanically what was special about this one. Spirit Island, the first time I played it, really impressed me in the way that it approached escalation. The way that the settlers come in, then those settlers create the settlements, and then they start moving inwards. Like, mechanically, and the AI of this game is actually incredibly brilliant, right? And I love the way that everything starts spreading around in conjunction with the almost like, what would I even call that? It's just this ability to kind of move. Nothing is stagnant here. You can move absolutely everything. You can manipulate all the pieces on the board, which gives everything a lot of flexibility.
It's a puzzle.
I thought all of that. Exactly. But it's a very amorphous puzzle at the same time, which I thought was really interesting for what is ultimately like a really hardcore mathy Euro in a lot of ways. I don't know. What are your thoughts on that? Like, what part captivated you?
Oh, I was just gonna say thank you for answering the question you asked me. Alex, what are you bringing in
today? I am bringing in Root, a game that both of you are imminently sounds like the wrong word, but I'm gonna stick with it, imminently familiar with it. Root is a game of adventure and
all right,
war.
So okay, I'm just gonna interrupt you right here. I'm also stepping back from this conversation until Jan locks in his vote, because I have some context that doesn't have me solidified in what's happening, but I do want to interject some conversation and poke some questions. But oh my God, I will say we've had multiple conversations
and this has been featured in multiple videos that we have done this past weekend. And you may have context, but nonetheless, Root is a game of woodland something factions fighting might and right. It's by Leader Games, and it features in the core game alone, it features four factions, which is going to expand outwards as you get expansions. Each one a complete asymmetric puzzle in how they play, how they win, how they score. The game manages to give you certain core mechanisms that all tie together, the way combat works, the way crafting items works, different things that tie in that are common structure to the board game, while enabling different factions that will interweave into something with those mechanics in different ways. Every factions are going to have their own unique way of how they work with the core mechanics of the game, how combat works, how rule of an area works, how you're going to craft items, how you're going to use those cards. All these things are going to be slightly different. Maybe way you score points. It's a fascinating puzzle of who is going to win, how they're going to win, how the factions will balance each other in the game, which player will take on which role, and just rinse repeat as you mix up the experience and puzzle time and time and time again. That is Root. That's the core of this concept, a game that has captured the imagination of a lot of people and continued to pump out more and more content for this game because of how well it is loved.
You're doing a good job masking your feelings here, although I think you kind of gave it away with two particular phrases that you did. And you've also been heavily sharing this, which to my mind sounds like you're trying to leverage controversy when you actually do publish your content. But before I get to that, Alex, are you a fan of war games?
I am a fan. Well, how do you define a war game?
Well, have you ever played a coin game before?
I haven't played any coin games. Sorry.
Out of the war games that you have played, can you mention one off the cuff that you
just
enjoy thoroughly?
It's going to very heavily be how you define a war game. I enjoy conflict. I enjoy powers and abilities and area control, but war games tend to be reserved for a specific sect of the board game space that I tend to not dabble in.
Okay. What is your opinion around asymmetric games where powers are solidified from their very onset, but they're incredibly different across the entire table?
I think they have huge potential for success and failure. I love the concept, but it has to be done with such delicate care and execution.
How much do you own of Root already?
Oh, well, I mean, that's I own the base game. I own the expansions in Shriek. I own all of it.
Okay. Jesse, I need to hear your questions before I make a determination on this. I'm leaning towards something, but I don't want to call it yet.
Not questions. I have no questions for the judge.
You have no questions? What are you going to interject with?
I just have a comment. A comment of frustration, a comment of desire, a comment of confusion. I do not know where he's going with this. I just have things I want to say, but I can't say them until I've heard your verdict.
Why do you make everything so difficult? Alex, this is difficult. This is a tricky one because the puzzle in Root is fascinating, and depending on the player type and the way that they just approach games of this nature is a haven. But at the same time, for somebody that's looking for things that are always growing and growing and becoming more powerful, I'm not sure if Root is going to be the one for you just because of how it plays. I feel I'm going to go bust today. I think you're selling this one. I don't think you're keeping it.
And Jesse?
Alex, we had such a good, lovely, enjoyable game that had a ending that people will
remember,
will want to stay tuned for. Yes, remember. So here's my thing. I think that session might have been enough for you. I think you got what you needed out of Root, and you may be selling it. Then again, I think that session might have reminded you and reinvigorated what is so lovely and charming and fascinating about this game, and rekindled a love that maybe you'd lost or not found before. I'm going to go with the arrogant choice, and that is going to be playing Root with me was a good enough time and experience that you would not... You would begrudge yourself to sell this game at this point.
Root, is a game that I regret purchasing, despite seeing why so many people would like the digital version of this game. For me, I will only be willing to play this in the tabletop version of the game that I am 100% keeping.
Yes!
But I do genuinely regret buying that one on Steam. I do not like the actual digital implementation of the game at all.
This is awesome. You're bringing in the Steam game, not the actual physical game.
No, I halfway through, I realized I can say it that way and then go with, I had no intent. But yeah, Root is the game that is simultaneously delightful and frustrating.
Wait. I'm way more interested in the Steam game for a moment. What don't you like about that application?
Sure. Let's talk about the Steam game for a minute. Let's take an interlude. So I did buy the Root implementation on Steam for $10 when it was on sale.
Because I have not yet purchased it, but I am planning a digital review of board games, like a collective one. And I've been steering weary of it.
I will say, take my overview of the way I approach digital implementations as a background for this feedback, and that is going to be that I have yet to enjoy any digital implementation of a game that tried to in any way graphically enhance the experience. At all, bar none. I have enjoyed
Terraforming Mars?
I hate it. Hate it. I love the game. Absolutely love the game. I hate the digital implementation. I like games on tabletop.
I found Scythe to be miserable.
I like games on Tabletop Simulator. I like games on Yukata where it's a pure view of the actual board. I have yet to enjoy a single game that was implemented digitally with graphical enhancements of any kind. Root, I think, did it fairly well. I think if you aren't turned off, you like Terraforming Mars, I think you'll enjoy Root. But for me, I don't like the fact that the information I want isn't at my fingertips. I have to go through the game constantly clicking on other people's boards to see what's going on, or just experience the game focusing on myself and not what others are doing. I found the Steam implementation of Root to be a good reminder of the mechanics of the game because I hadn't played it in a year and a half, but I would only be willing to play it on Steam again if like people really, really wanted to. I was not a fan of that.
So I'm correct. The experience you had with me was good enough to remind you how terrible the Steam version is and how wonderful the physical one is.
You are correct in your answer, but you are also arrogant in your answer at the same time. I have played Root a few times.
I'm okay with that.
I played Root this past Thursday. So again, I used to own Root a long time ago, and I always thought it was a great game even as I got rid of it. Because I got rid of it because it wasn't going to see consistent play with my game group, but the pandemic has changed that. What used to be a game group of 20 people has now locked down to 4 people and just the same 4. So we simultaneously do have a game group, we do interact, but we also at the same time are mindful of having a larger interaction with a larger group of people. So we've dumbed it down to a core set of people to play this game, and we decided this was an opportunity to get it back. So I played it this past Thursday night on Steam, just a week ago. I played it on Steam Thursday night to give it a shot. From there, I played it Friday night in person with that group, and then I played it Saturday in person with that group. And by Saturday day, I was sure that it was staying in my collection for quite some time. And then I played it with Jesse, and Jesse's game was certainly enjoyable, but you did not push me over any edges by the time.
We mixed it up, though. We played with the Vagabonds and Partisan. We played on the mountain map. We had King of the Hill going on. We used some expansion characters, all things that you had not experienced before.
And I'll give you that part of... I have a lot of critiques about Root, and I won't go into it now because I will save it for a particular video that is going up on Quackalope's channel.
No. It's not going up on my channel.
My channel. It's going up on my channel. I will save it for a video that's going up on my channel where I talk about Root with Jesse, and I'll save those critiques. But the overall takeaway is that Root is a game that I think that I should not like by any number of different counts, and yet I do. And what that game with you did, Jesse, is that game did it validated one of my suspicions about Root, which is one of the things that will take away from my complaints, is the degree to which you can mix up and change the experience as opposed to being locked into consistent pre-scripted roles all the time.
Sure.
And so I guess you helped to a degree. You're not the worst person I've played a game with, but Root is a delightful experience that I will simultaneously complain about the reasons I shouldn't like it, the reasons it shouldn't be in my collection, while asking you to sit down and play another game with me.
Settle down, settle down. It's time for our Medley Minute, a moment of respite before the rest of our show.
Okay, boys, so right now I'm going to pass you some Rat Butt.
Rat Butt?
Yes.
Who are you passing? What?
I'm going to give this one to you, Jesse. Is it Rat Butt or is it not Rat Butt?
Okay, all right. This card, I'm going to... It is not rat butt. It is instead a duck fact. Did you know that eggs will hatch within 28 days normally, except for the muskoi duck, which takes about 35 days to hatch? That's right. The mother duck will then also keep her brood of ducklings together to protect them from predators. Any ducklings that you see waddling around in a little tiny herd, like an adorable little line of protected creatures, that's exactly what they're doing. By uniforming and forming into a larger mass, like a duck bowling ball, these little ducks are actually protecting themselves from sky demons and feral foxes.
Wow. I gotta say, we have two episodes now that we have not done any duck facts. I'm kind of glad they're back in a weird way.
It has been suspiciously absent, and what a great opportunity time to bring them in middle of a segment about rat butt.
Yeah, rat butt. So are you saying that this is not a rat butt then, Jesse? Is that your official claim?
No. It is not a rat butt. But we'll pause there, and I'm going to be talking about Spire's End, a digital adaptation of a physical board game,
Slay the
I believe.
Spire, Jesse.
That I absolutely... Oh, sorry, I got that backwards. Did you all know that Spire's End,
the amazing
digital deck-building game, is coming out with a physical adaptation of a digital game? Hopefully, this one won't screw it up.
I'm really nervous about this one, actually.
Yeah, I brought this in for my Medley Minute as well, because...
What?
No. We don't share Medley Minutes. What are you doing?
I didn't care.
Lazy behavior. What do you mean you brought the same thing?
All right. The only way this is acceptable is if you have more information than me, and all the information I have is that they're doing
it. Yeah,
ooh,
I mean,
that's a lot of information, Alex.
Well, let's start with the baseline, Jesse. Can this succeed? Can this be a notable, equitable balance to that digital implementation of the game?
You mean the physical game or the financial profitability of selling an IP that is...
The physical game. Will it live up?
Okay, because financially, this is going to go gangbusters. The physical game, No way. Not even close.
Not even close. I cannot fathom how they could make this work.
What it can do, and what I am looking forward to, is the fact that I don't always want to play the digital implementation. There are many times that I will rather have the tactile feature of a game. This might be able to succeed in giving you a multiplayer experience that is enjoyable that the single player one does not currently. There are avenues and pathways that they can explore if they focus more on what they can do well, rather than trying to mimic purely the digital experience.
I think you're right, but I'm always so scared of people not doing something new with an IP, especially when it's already beloved so much. I mean, I have one word for you that is my pure fire reason why this will never replicate what the digital game does for me, and that is going to be artifacts.
Yeah, so that's the problem. There are so many things in the digital version of the game that some are going to be hard to mimic, and some are possible to mimic but will make the game tedious and the work you have to go through.
It's one of the best parts, getting all of these little items and trinkets and abilities that chain and grow and build your deck in a unique and complex way, and the amount of character development that happens as you're progressing up the spire. It is all done by math that would be miserable to do on
the
correct.
And also, many of the cards literally have functions where your card will multiply, will disappear, will do different things in ways that you couldn't possibly.
Yeah, the inaccessibility of this is going to be off the rails. It's just going to be impossible to keep track of every single modifier that's on the table.
Yeah, the aspect of growing your strength and tracking that on every single thing, looking at the enemies in the balance. Slay the Spire is possibly my favorite deck building game of all time, and it works in the digital space.
I don't think you're wrong.
And here's another thing that I think is really interesting. Hand of Fate Ordeals, which is a game that I thought was really cool. It wasn't perfect, but it was incredibly well done in the board gaming space. Did something really cool with deck building, but they did not follow the straight up formula that the original had. I'm not sure if that was the reason of its demise, but I thought it was novel.
The only way this succeeds as a game is to disappoint the people that want it to replicate the digital,
which I hope they do.
And yep, I agree.
Which I hope they do. But if they do, I mean, it is such a weird position. I understand why they want to make this. I understand why they're trying to adapt it. There is a profit opportunity. There is an IP opportunity. There is the natural desire from a fan base, the amount of people who are super excited about this. But I am aggressively skeptical. And yet, I will still be getting 100%. It. I will still be hopefully covering it. Not even as a content creator. I'm just talking in general as a fan of that core system. Me and everyone else will be checking this out, which means they've got a lot riding on them. The good news for Jan is we've already lowered his expectations, Alex. So the odds of him loving it
unless they can clearly show me on that Kickstarter page when it comes out why they screwed this up before I even get it, I'll be backing it. I mean, sure. Both as a content creator, I would love to be involved in covering the game beforehand. But just as a fan,
of course,
I will get the
and
game.
I'm hoping both of our channels will have the opportunity to cover this for our
do
fans.
Do we know who's actually going to be publishing and who designed this so far?
Contention Games.
Contention Games. Is that a new one?
I haven't really heard of them myself, but they do have like one other game under their belt called Imperium the Contention, which is a fairly new game, only just landed in 2020. It has a rating of 8.6, but with only, 26 ratings. So
yeah, 20-something ratings. The entire staff and someone's mother.
There's enough there to say the game isn't, their game isn't horrible. We're not seeing a bunch of people trashing it, but also not nearly enough people coming out and saying how good it is. So untested, unvalidated. I'm excited.
If it's my thing on things like that is like, if it really is an 8.6, it would be good enough to have more ratings.
I mean, I think initially games will have a certain degree of ratings. Like, I don't think there's any validation going on, but nor do I think there's no one trashing the game either.
That's what I'm saying. I don't discount it, but I also don't listen to it.
Well, I'm with you.
The other thing that we would need to verify is that how was Contention made? Was Contention Games made out of, incredible designers across the field or professionals that have demonstrated their,
Let's do some more research. Let's continue digging in and update people as we come. This is going to be one of the most interesting stories of 2021 for me. And I'm really excited to follow this journey, whether it is a catastrophic failure or a brilliant success of a deck builder game. All that being said, we did leave the audience on a cliffhanger. Jan, I'm passing you a rap butt.
Well, Jesse, this is not a rap butt. It is actually some incredible news that I think you specifically are going to be very excited about.
Probably not.
Do you know by memory the publisher Hans M. Gluck?
Nope, don't know.
You actually have them in your library right now by a little game called Russian Railroads. Remember that one?
Yeah, I remember that one.
On December 31st, Hans M. Gluck posted a picture on Facebook announcing both Ultimate Railroads Edition, which is obviously going to be the big box version reprint of Russian Railroads with potentially all the expansions, and the Carcassonne 20th year edition.
I believe it cannot be called Russian Railroads because that IP is tied up in some legal issues. So Ultimate Railroads is an interesting way to adapt your mechanics into a new big box. I like that creativity, potentially. Cool. I mean, that's interesting. It's fine. I already own a copy. I don't need another one.
Well, I'm assuming that this is going to have something that's either refreshed or just the entire conglomeration of everything that's ever come out for Russian Railroads, which I think is really exciting. I can't wait to finally own this game because, Jesse, I don't have this, and a lot of other people don't have this. This has been out of print for over, 8 years now or something along those lines. It's just been very difficult to get your hands on.
Yeah, it's okay. It's an okay game. I'm not a huge fan.
Okay, let's go through the math here because, let's see. So the rating on BGG is a 7.8 across 2,300 different comments and 15,000 ratings with a 3.41 rate.
Jen, I think you misheard Alex. He didn't say he was correct. He just said he wasn't a fan.
Sure. I just want to make sure for people that may have not heard of Russian Railroads that you should much be excited about this. And if you don't know about it but you're curious, I would just say go ahead and get this because the value of this game, once this is done with, because I'm assuming as an Ultimate Edition that's not going to come out again, is going to be astronomical in terms of its value proposition either way. So definitely something to look out for in 2021. Wow. And this is also going to go to retail. It's not going to be a Kickstarter.
Jan's kind of stepping on your toes there with value propositions and all that nonsense, Alex.
Am I wrong, Alex?
No, he's not wrong. The game is well sought after for any number of reasons that I'm sure I don't know. People like it. It's well rated. It will potentially go out of print again as soon as people realize it's not. I'm hating on this game a little too aggressively. It's a good game that is not for me. And I go into that in depth when I cover the top 10 worst games in Quackalope's collection.
Oh my God. Are you really? You're holding too much out on us, Alex.
I already did.
Yeah, we've got a top 10 list coming to Board Game Co's channel probably next week sometime. And let me just say, Russian Railroads is not the most controversial thing on that list.
Oh.
All right, Jen, I'm going to pass you another card. You ready?
Yes, I think so.
This is an elephant.
And no, that's a... Oh, holy Whoa. Cow!
Hi.
Hey, Sarah!
That was amusing. Well played. Hello, Sarah. How's it going?
Hi, how are you? I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Doing good. Monsieur Elephant, yeah. Miss Elephant.
What a transition, everybody. Jesse had turned off his camera temporarily and apparently subbed in Sarah Shaw from Board Wait, Games in a Minute. Yes.
Are we doing this?
That is right.
Oh, we're 100% we doing are. This. Cool. Yes, we are.
Yeah, I'm excited. This is my first time on the Weekly Quack.
Welcome, Sarah. Excited. It's about time, right?
Yeah. Yes.
Oh, so oh, actually.
Oh, wait, no, I know what's happening here. Sarah. Are you by any chance
yes.
doing Jesse's On the Radar?
I am.
What?
Yeah,
well, that's
no,
awesome.
No, it means I already know more than I should because I happen to know a game that Sarah is very excited about. A game that she has been talking about, she's been interested in, she's been mentioning it here and there, which means I have to imagine that today you are bringing in Darwin's Journey.
That is right. I am. So this is a worker placement game, a heavy Euro game by two designers that I really like. They designed games such as Newton and mm-hmm. Lorenzo Il Magnifico and Barrage, which I haven't played, but I hear Jan really likes. So Simone Luciani and Nestor Mangone. I think I totally butchered that name. So
no,
apologies.
I think you got at least one of those right. The second one, I'm pretty sure, but
yeah,
I'm not
I
certain.
I don't even yeah. want to try pronouncing those names, Sarah. And I'm Latino, so.
Yeah.
I will publicly and forever forgive everyone who leaves the E off the end of my name, because most people do. There is an E at the end of Radcliffe, but I understand and recognize that it's hard. But at least you're getting the pronunciation right.
Okay, good. Yeah. So this is published by Thundergriff Games, and it is on Kickstarter right now until January 28th. And I got a chance to play the prototype, and I really loved it. So in this game, you are basically reimagining Darwin's journey through the Galapagos Islands. And you have so many things you need to do in this game. But the main important thing you need to do in this game is discover new species in the Galapagos Islands, and then be the first one, hopefully, to put them into the museums, the specimens into the museums, because that's how you're going to get the vast majority of your points in this game. You can get points in other ways as well, such as, you know, by corresponding with other scientists. You know, you have letters and you can correspond with other people. You can unlock new tiles with your own personal lens tokens, special action tiles. You will also need to make sure you have the appropriate seals for your workers. So you start off with four workers in this game, and you can acquire a fifth one during the game, but you need various seals in order for the different worker spots on the board. So you also need to make sure you're getting the seals that you need. There is an ocean track as well. You can research new species even if you haven't been the first one to discover them. So there's a lot going on in this game. It is a really heavy worker placement game. I really enjoyed my play of it. So this is my On the Radar.
Yeah, I've been seeing everyone buzz about this game. And I will say, this is one that, for me, I've yeah. heard about. I've seen the things. It's something about it never really pulled me in. Honestly, I would say the thing that has me most interested this whole time has been your excitement about just this game and everything going on in it.
Alex, other notable titles from these designers, Marco Polo 2, Grand Austria Hotel, Zolkin. These guys are on absolute fire. I am so excited. Either way, go ahead, Alex.
I'm just curious, what game would you say this is most reminiscent of in terms of the feeling, something about it, reasons to like it, who if someone played this game, then they should try Darwin's Journey? I'm curious. It's beautifully looking.
Newton. Have you played
Newton? Haven't. I need to.
That was a really good one.
Oh my gosh, I need to.
Yeah, that had so much going on in it as well. It's been a long time since I've played it, but when I played it, my mind was blown. I remember how it seemed like there was different areas of the board which you can progress in. It's a long time, but I remember you could maybe go from like university to university, if I remember correctly. There was many different areas of the board where you could progress your workers and then build up your own like knowledge in your own personal board. And this felt a lot like that, if I remember correctly. And I think a lot of people who liked Newton would like this game. And I think I've read comments that a lot of people say this is like kind of a reimagining of Newton, maybe. So, you know, different theme. It's beautiful. And so, I think people should definitely check this one out.
Yeah, I know. And one thing that's really interesting. So going back to the designer, Simone Luciani is a juggernaut in this space, right? He has over 50, well, based on BGG, he has like in conjunction between expansions and actual games, like 50 titles under his belt. However, the titles that have overlap between Simon and Nestor is actually going to be Newton. It's also going to be Masters of Renaissance, the card game, which I find really intriguing, right? Because most of Simon's most notable games are actually his own separate titles, or at least the titles that he hasn't worked directly with Nestor. So I'm curious to see how their partnership has evolved across the years. And like you said, like maybe it is Newton reimagined and perfected to absolutely every degree possible that it could have been perfected to. All I know is that I have not been excited about a single game for the past 3 months, and finally, something has popped on my radar that I actually decided to back immediately as soon as I find out who was behind this. So yes, color me intrigued. I cannot wait to try this one out. And I've never played Newton, but based on what I'm looking at, yes, this definitely does seem like an evolution of that system.
I think so. So yeah, I am super excited about this game.
And Sarah, what exactly did you love about Darwin's Journey so far? Was it the way that your workers are slowly progressing and evolving and gaining basically experience as they do things? Is it more like the exploration factor across the board? I think Man vs. Meeple compared it to Great Western Trail at some point, which immediately gets me super excited. Or was it more like that tile laying and combo-esque feeling of it? Like, what specifically did you love?
Yeah, I definitely wouldn't call it a tile laying game. Like, the only time you're really laying tiles is when you've discovered a species and you are the first one to display them in the museum. So you just pick up that tile and put it down, and then you get your bonuses from that. And so I wouldn't call it really a tiling game, but I really do love worker placement. And it's such a tight game. There's only 5 rounds in this game, but because you need to get the appropriate seals for your workers, you really need to think about where you can go. And if you're not the first worker in a spot, then you also have to pay coins, and money is really hard to come by in this game. So you really need to think carefully about where you're going and how to get the points you need. It is a very tight game because money is so hard to come by. Because if you're not the first worker, you would have to pay a cost, and you might not be able to pay that cost. So yeah, you might need to rethink your whole strategy.
That's a mechanism that we had in Voyages of Marco Polo as well.
Oh, I've been wanting to try that one.
Yeah, like there were certain times where my spot that I wanted to go in was taken and I didn't have the cost to pay. So, you know, I'd have to do something that I maybe didn't want to do. But so you really have to rethink your strategy at times. I really liked it. It's a very tight game.
Yeah, well, color me intrigued.
No, this looks amazing.
Yeah. Jen, what did you bring to the table this
week? For my On the Radar today, I have decided to bring in a game that Jesse and I played basically a year ago, I believe, by the name of Kohaku by Gold Seal Games. So Kohaku is a peaceful koi pond building tile laying game where each turn players are going to be drafting both adjacent koi and feature tiles from a central pond board to place into their own personal koi pond. The aim is to plan out your tiles to maximize different scoring conditions throughout the game. Kois are mostly multipliers in a sense that you're going to be placing in the pond to multiply point values on other tiles, which are called those features. So for example, you have flowers that are going to score for adjacent koi. You have rocks that are going to score for other elements that are in around the koi tiles themselves. You have turtles and statues that are going to score straight points, and you have other different tiles that just add a little bit more variability and spice into how you do the end game scoring. There's not going to be any restrictions on how you grow your pawns precisely. However, once you place a tile, it'll never be able to be moved again. So you have to be very careful and tactical how you decide to, you know, expand and grow out your pond. After there are no coal tiles left or available to refill the central pond board, the game ends immediately. Players will be totaling the points scored by each feature in their pond based on the koi they have and the colors they decided to draft. And finally, the player with the most points wins.
Yeah, the artwork in this game is stunning. Do you know if the tiles are acrylic or...
I have this game already in here in my library, actually.
There is an acrylic tile version from the Kickstarter.
Oh my God.
And I've already looked at it. It is absolutely stunning. So there's two versions of this game, as Alex just pointed out. You have a cardboard version, and then you have, I'm not sure if it's a Kickstarter exclusive, but assume it's almost like a deluxified copy of the same tiles, but with a double layered acrylic effect. So on the top of the acrylic, you're going to have either like the head of a fish poking out, or maybe butterflies going on top of it, the ripples of water, and then underneath the acrylic, you have the actual graphic. And that layered effect just gives this game a really beautiful sheen, and it pops on the table more than you would expect. I actually haven't had the opportunity to play this yet, which is why it's on my radar and not in my shelf for sale section, but I am incredibly excited to dig into this once more, because when Jesse and I played it, it was merely just a prototype, but we had a fantastic time with this game. The level of flexibility and liberty that you have to kind of grow out that pawn feels really interesting and yet complex. Every single feature tile has a consequence to where you're placing it, and every single koi is so important to where you're placing it, because there's two things you have to keep in mind. First, you can never place two kois immediately adjacent to each other. So imagine that the game kind of builds out as a checkerboard almost, kois always being like at corners instead of anywhere else. And everything in between that is the features. But depending on the features that you get, and also the colored koi that you have to place in these different sectors of 4x4, you start either maximizing everything in a way that's amazing, or you just start really having a lot of difficulty kind of going for what you need. Because the way that the game does is that when you draft the tiles, as I mentioned in the overview, you have to draft adjacent. So there's limitations as to how you can grow out your koi pond based on what's in the selection. I don't know. Honestly, it was fantastic. Have either of you heard of this one before, or maybe watched the Kickstarter?
I've heard of it. Yeah, no, I did not notice it when it was on Kickstarter, which I really regret because I want those acrylic tiles. It looks absolutely stunning. I've seen photos of it and it is gorgeous. Like, yeah.
Yeah, I haven't seen this one on Kickstarter. I mean, everything you're saying sounds interesting. There's a whole bunch of games in this genre of puzzly games. You have to manage different objectives and try to figure out the way to have them work together in the most efficient ways. Games like Sprawlopolis, not Calico, but what was the newest one that just came out this year? From the designers of Calico.
Oh, Cascadia.
Cascadia is going to have that again. So I'm curious what this one does differently to stand out. It's rated well, seemingly, so far. And the general puzzle intrigues me. The design aspects sound very fascinating. But I'm very curious whether this would end up staying or whether it would be...
the most unique element of this is definitely going to be the aesthetics, you know, kind of like that peacefulness to it. It's just, it feels very calming when you play it. But specifically, the way that you draft the tiles, I feel, is pretty ingenious. Kind of the way that it kind of works, it feels like it's an actual pawn that's alive and thriving. It starts off everything from the center, and then it kind of grows from there. I think it's around maybe 12 tiles that you draft. So if you draft anything from the edges of the pond, everything from the center builds outwards. So the positioning of the entire drafting element is constantly in shift, right? So nothing is secure to where it's at. So you could create either chain effects where you took a tile that might not have been the perfect one for you to take, but you are preparing yourself for the next round. So now you have your perfect koi and also your perfect feature. And there's also like these other mechanics where some of the fish just like swim away from the pond. I think it's been a long time since I play it. That also adds kind of to that intrigue and to that drafting element. And the puzzle in front of you is also really it's interesting. It's not as ingenious to me as maybe the core element of the drafting, but I feel that drafting is enough to really give this its own legs. Both Jesse and I, from what I remember, we were both huge fans of the game. I cannot wait to bring it to Shelf or Sell to talk about it a little bit more in depth and with a lot more experience under my belt.
The way you're describing the game, it kind of almost sounds a little bit like Dragon Castle, which is from the same culture too, like this Japanese culture. Have you played Dragon Castle?
No, I have not.
I have been intrigued by that one as well.
Dragon Castle.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All I have to say about this one is that I was a big fan of Tricky Tides, the first game published by Gold Seal Games. So I have no doubt that this will definitely be a keeper in my library. But with all that said, Alex, what about you? What are you bringing in today?
Today, I am bringing in a late pledge because Kickstarter is still recovering. Mm-hmm. Retail options is nothing currently on my radar. And so I dived down into my late pledges, which I recently just did a whole deep dive on. And I pulled out of my hat Wonderlands War.
Oh, wow.
Wonderlands War, which I believe, Jan, you had the opportunity to play it.
No, maybe? Not me. Unfortunately, no, I did not Jesse? Have the opportunity. Yep, it was Jesse and
Sarah,
Co.
Are you familiar with this game, Sarah?
I am very familiar with it because I am a huge Alice in Wonderland fan.
Ooh, did you back this game? Did you back this game?
I unfortunately did not, but I might have to dive into the late pledge like you.
Fun fact. So you can certainly late back this game. Wonderlands War is a game. This is going to be put out by Skybound Games, by Druid City Games, and this is going to be one of their bigger Kickstarters that has come out with 8,713 backers, $680,000 raised, and this is going to be a combination of area control, combat, and fighting combined with a bag building element. AKA sort of similar to Quacks of Quedlinburg and what it's trying to do. There's going to be an element of building out your chips, building out your deck, moving around your table, picking your cards, your unique competitive advantages, figuring out how to best min-max your way to building out that combination of things that will complement both the current game state, both the cards and the chips you have already, both your unique asymmetric factions and how they operate on this board, and then taking that to the actual combat of this game, applying it to the actual area control elements of how this game will play out. And for me, one of the things, which Sarah, you touched upon already to a degree, but one of the things that to me stood out about this game is both the combination of the unique mechanics and the way they have different mechanics from a game all combined in ways that normally they don't. Normally these types of game mechanics do not combine in a single game. And then additionally, that theme is unique. It stands out. I've never seen Alice in Wonderland in a designer game before, and I like having unique themes in my games, combined with art by, I believe the art was by Manny Tremblay. It's like amazingly gorgeous art.
It is.
It's the art stands out. The production quality of Druid City Games, the Skybound Games, is always incredible. All in all, Wonderlands War is a game that I am incredibly excited about, and the late pledge is still open.
So this is one that when I saw it first, I had a little bit of reservations of, because it sure, the mechanics seem fascinating, but at the same time, it seems like it could be overwhelming at the same time. You know, there's a lot happening in this game that I don't know if it's going to be balanced well when the final product comes out. Like, I hope it does. Based on what I saw from the Quackalo video, I think it was still kind of reaching that point of being fine-tuned. So I'm really curious. Alex, have you been keeping up with the development of the game at all? Like, have you read the final rule book or anything like that that gives an inkling to how the game has maybe progressed since the first days that we saw it?
I don't have that, but I do know, I don't know when your feedback or different aspects came into play or whatnot, but I know that when Man vs. Meeple said it, when they covered the game, they talked about how they were involved for a long time with the game, and they did see it evolve in many different ways. So I don't know exactly to what degree. I don't know what things have changed over time. I'm totally fine with the concept that I may well be let down by this game. I back many games. Some are incredible, amazing experiences that I keep for years. Some are delightfully entertaining and I hold onto it until eventually time moves on and I find myself not pulling out anymore. And some are disappointing from the get-go, whether across the board to many backers or potentially just to myself. I know many games, Dwellings of Eldervale is a great example of a game that for myself, I have not enjoyed that game. And yet
I need to play this.
So I should take my words. I should use my words carefully. I have not enjoyed Dwellings of Eldervale compared to other games in that genre for myself. It's a game I would happily play, but I don't feel the need to own. And yet so many people are raving about it. And so it could be an incredible game for me. It could be an incredible game for others. It could be a dud across the board. I don't know where it'll end up, but it's pretty. It has mechanics I like. It has powers and abilities and unique factions. It has the production quality of Druid City Games. There's so many reasons for me to give this one a chance that I'm giving it a chance.
Did you go for the retail or the deluxe?
Oh, I went for the deluxe all in. When I back a game on Kickstarter, I want all the heavy chips, all the amazing miniatures, all if I will not like this game, then I'll be able to get rid of it, because these types of games will hold. Tidal Blaze, the most recent game from Skybound Games, is one that, whether you liked it or not, it's one that does hold its value initially, as people see other people getting their pledges and they want them, and they pay that premium because there's that FOMO of, if the game is well rated, that price will only go up. So I have no concerns about getting my money back. And if I like it, well, then I want all the pretty things.
And Sarah, when you were looking at this way back, was there a particular reason why you didn't decide to go for it at that time? Or was it just
finances, purely financial mm-hmm. reason? Yeah.
And so now that you're looking at it again, is beyond just like the Alice in Wonderland theme, is there anything else that has you excited about the game?
The gameplay itself, I actually watched a full playthrough of it that when they were doing it live. I remember James and a few other people were doing a live gameplay and I watched the entire thing. So it intrigued me a lot. It's just financial reasons I couldn't do it at the time. So, you know, if they can keep open their late pledges for maybe another month while I get some finances together, maybe I can hop in on those too. Yeah, it's really cool to see like a game with different player powers and, you know, them battling for areas with Alice in Wonderland theme. Like the theme is within this game is just awesome.
I was about to, like, the final question that I wanted to ask both of you before we end the show and move into audience feedback was, what stood out to you in terms of the mechanics? At least for me, when I saw everything, I thought it was a really interesting take on bag building, how bag building can be made as an aggressive format, you know, competitively, a lot of very heavy on conflicts. What about you two?
Yeah, no. So for me, that's one of the reasons why I'm uncertain about this game while being intrigued, because if it's done well, it has so much potential for being unique, something that stands out, and games just being copies of other games works to a degree, but I like variation. Versus the flip side is the bag building of Quacks of Quedlinburg works well because it's a game that plays in 45 minutes, mm-hmm. and I don't really mind the luck idea that you might have gotten better draws from your bag, and that's okay, and that's fine. Versus I can see the potential for an area control game that is heavily conflict based, when you get stomped on because somebody else just drew better chips and had a significantly better degree of luck, I can see that being frustrating. My hope is that they've managed it and built a system around it that works well, but for sure there's room for things to not be a fit for me as well.
Yeah, two other games that have bag building that I really love are Quacks of Quedlinburg, like Alex mentioned, and Altiplano. I am excited to see how it works in this game. Yeah.
Yeah, and Orléans is also well recommended in general. Orléans, I mean, Altiplano I haven't played. Orléans I played a long time ago, but I need to play it again. But yeah.
Oh, no, you need to play Altiplano. Yeah.
And so, Alex, when is this late pledge closing?
I do not have a firm date as to when it's closing, but hopefully it's still open when you go check it out.
Okay, and Sarah, so the last card that I'm going to give you before we end the show is going to be a bat.
A bat?
A bat.
Okay.
I don't think Sarah's been playing this game, Jen. Sarah has no idea. Sarah, have you played Cockroach Poker?
No, I have no idea. No.
So let me take this opportunity to give you a quick overview of how the game works. For those who've actually listened through this thing and have no idea how it works,
like
the
me.
General idea of Cockroach Poker is that one player picks a card from their hand and says, I have a bat. And then they pass it to another player. At that point, the player has a choice. They can either call true or false, it is a bat, I believe you, or it's not a bat, I don't, or they can choose to look at it themselves and pass it to the next person. So you grab the card, you look at it, and you turn to me, and you say, Alex, it's not a bat, it's a cockroach. And you hand it to me, and then I now have a choice. Do I listen to Jan's initial choice of what it was? Do I listen to you? Or do I perhaps think you're both lying on something else entirely? It's a bluffing thing that works well and plays well off the idea, the fact that the cards go through multiple hands, and you start getting a taste and a feel of when a truth is being told, when lies are being spread, when the entire thing is interesting, and then ultimately you lose when you have four of a kind. And so as the table develops, it stops being a pure guessing of random or not random and other players. It starts being a thing of, well, of course they're going to try to pass me a cockroach because I have three, and if I get one more, I'm done.
Oh, that sounds fun.
It is
fun.
A delightful
like
bluffing
that.
Game that really needs a minimum of three, ideally four, I would say, is my ideal for this game. And the first game is a little bit of a chaotic madness as you try to figure out the system of, I believe you, I don't believe you, and all that. But once you get like a game or two under your belt, which only takes 5 minutes per game, it is delightfully maddening in what it ends up doing and the sheer amount of laughter around the table.
Yeah, I want to play.
Well, you are playing, Sarah.
Okay, I am playing.
I gave you a bat.
And I say you're lying. It is not a bat.
Darn it, you're right. It was a quackalope.
A quack.
Oh, of course it was.
This latest failed attempt at bringing you quality entertainment was brought to you by the Quackalope Podcast. We love to hear from you, so don't forget to leave a review and subscribe. If you'd like to connect with us, follow us on any of our social channels or visit our website. But regardless of what you do, remember to do the important thing. Get out and play some games. Until next time.
All right, guys, as we are wrapping up, let's get into audience feedback.
Yes, audience feedback. Alex, I'm trusting you brought a question in today.
No, not a question so much as a general post. You see, it has been a little lighter around the holidays, and there hasn't been that much in the way of questions. So today I figured I'd ask my own question because New Year's came and went, and it's a new year. You know, it's a single day. It's a new change, not a drastic degree of anything. But I figured I'd just ask what games people have been playing because I know my New Year's started off with a bang. I've gotten a few games to the table already. I've gotten, games like Root to the table. I've gotten Kingdom Rush and Primal, and I'd have to go through my list. Cockroach Poker, in fact, I've played in the New Year. I've played Core Quest, a prototype coming. I've played a whole bunch of games since the New Year began, and I just asked in our Facebook group and in the Quackalo podcast on Facebook, I just asked, what have people been playing? And I got so many answers of the games people have gotten to the table already in just 5 days of games like Moonmakers, Marvel United, 4, Tammany Hall, Tidal Blades, Honey Buzz, a game that I know you love, Sarah, Parks.
Oh,
yeah,
I love
Parks
it.
Got multiple plays, Forgotten Waters. What else we have? We have Agricola, Silver and Gold, Last Aurora, Dwellings of Eldervales, Viscounts of the West Kingdom, and the Crokinole, Terraforming Mars. There's so many games that have been played in our group by so many people, many of which that I am incredibly excited to get to the table myself, and including Honey Buzz, which my copy finally just arrived, and I'm excited to get one to the table as well. It's so Yay. Many things going on here that, yeah, it's fun to see.
People. Did you back Honey Buzz on Kickstarter,
didn't.
Alex?
I did not back it, but I did trade for a Kickstarter copy.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so I have everything but the coins, so I'm intrigued. We'll see how it plays out.
Of course you traded for a copy, Alex. Of course you did.
I had no choice. Sarah has been going on and on about it, and other people have been backing it up. I need to get this game.
It's so good. Yes.
I am so envious of you. I have not had the opportunity. I think I haven't played an actual board game in the longest time. I'm starting to get depressed, and I'm starting to actually believe you guys when you say that I don't like board games anymore because I just don't get them to the table at all. All my friends are not available right now. I don't like playing gay board games online.
Move to Ithaca. We can play board games.
I know. Ithaca sounds perfect right now. I need to play all the, like, I have Dwellings of Eldervale, I have Kingdom Rush, I have Tekkenu, I just got the prototype in for Crash Octopus that I cannot wait to bring to the table. I have, what else? I have Kohaku that I just got. Now I got Ghost Blitz, I have Skulls, I have Cockroach Poker, I have so many games. Someone send help, please. Someone, and when I say help, I mean you. Send yourself so we can play games. Por favor. What about you, Sarah? Have you broken this curse that I'm apparently stuck in?
Well, since New Year's, I've been helping my sister move in Florida. So I'm currently in Florida, where Jesse is as well. So, you know, we're hitting up Wizarding World tomorrow. But the last game I played was on New Year's Eve, which was Paris, Cité des Lumières. Oh. It's a two-player game with my younger sister. So I guess my question for everyone is, what is your favorite two-player game? And not a game that can be played at two players, but is specifically designed to be a two-player game.
Favorite is a hard one.
I've played a few.
There are so many good
ones. I've played a couple. There's Curious Cargo, which is amazing.
Do you want something lighter? Do you want something deeper? What are you looking for?
Any. If, you know, it has to be your favorite. So as long as it's your favorite.
Don't take Watergate from me, Alex. Ooh, that's my vote.
I do like Watergate.
You can have Watergate. It's a great choice. Yeah. I mean, Codename's Duet is my go-to lighter one in terms of the genre. I love Hanamakoji for something that's incredibly deep and tactical that you can play in 5 minutes.
Yeah.
If you're not afraid of big boxes, you can play things like Super Fantasy Brawl, things like Rum and Bones for a tactical attacking and powering and leveling up
Undaunted.
Experience. Undaunted. There's so many good two-player games out there. It's such an amazing space that we're in right now that basically anything has the opportunity to be a good game for the right
Isn't
people.
Isn't Targi a two-player game too, Alex?
Targi is a great two-player game, two-player experience that has tactical worker placement with blocking that works really well. Seven Wonders Duel is going to be another. There are just so many solid games to pull out. Blitzkrieg, you said Watergate already. Battle Line, Terra Nova.
I envy Alex's knowledge and repertoire here. Oh, he always has answers. Always.
Well, I mean, I play a lot of two-player games. It's not my go-to, but it is a big chunk of my gaming. I mean, Attack, if you want something abstract, oh my gosh, Attack is one, is not one of, Attack is my favorite abstract board game, bar none. It is so deep in what it's doing, and it's so simple and accessible and how to get it to the table. You can play, you can knock out a game in 5 minutes as you go back and forth, realizing the strategy with each additional game, and then continuing to escalate and grow in the experience it's providing. It's so much fun. And then there's cooperative things. You can play Zombicide: Black Plague. You can play Cthulhu: Death May Die.
Sarah,
you played Cthulhu: Death May Die?
Wait, okay. So I feel like you both were talking at the same time. I have played Cthulhu: Death May Die. I don't know what.
And tell me you love it. Tell me you love it.
I regret giving away my copy. If that answers your question,
Sarah. Oh no.
Yeah. No, Sarah. I know.
It's okay. It's okay. It's all good.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's a lot of good games out there, a lot of opportunities to play, a lot of amazing experiences.
What was your question, Jan?
Oh, he was just telling me that Cthulhu: Death May Die was not a two-player exclusive game.
No, it's not.
Yeah. Which he's right.
It's not.
Yeah, yeah. Alex, you don't want to ask me that question, by the way. So my question for audience feedback today is going to be from Alex Cisneros. I'm bringing this one back from Alex's larger set of questions that we made earlier in the year. So Alex Cisneros asked, what is the best way to sort a collection on the shelves? And I think that's a great question for the new year, as we're all kind of like reshuffling our lives back to normalcy. So I'll leave this up to you guys to answer first.
Yeah, some of my shelves I do by size, like box size. If they fit perfectly next to each other, then I'll do it that way. Sometimes, like, some of them are arranged by theme, like a lot of, like, I have two shelves dedicated to games that have like a world or city theme. So really, you know, it can be multiple different ways on all of my different shelves. And some are like, you know, nice collectible games or like heavier games. So it's a whole mishmash of stuff, honestly.
So for me, the only correct answer is going to be alphabetically by color. Absolutely. You have to. That's the only way to do it. No, but in all seriousness, I've gone through a lot of different ways. I constantly mix up my shelves in the way I arrange them. But the general category I tend to stick with the most is who I play those games with. Mm-hmm. I've tried going through player count, like ideal player count. I find it doesn't work. Box size is always a factor to a degree, but as someone who goes with a calyx shelving, ultimately all cubbies are the same. And so you have to, within those categories, you have to make everything fit. But really, it's a general feeling I have of a game. So my Ameritrash games are going to fall into one specific genre. Those Zombicides, those Cthulhu: Death May Die, those Rum and Bones. The games I play with my kids are going to have their own shelving section, like the family games. Two-player games tend to have their own shelving section. One-player solo experiences tend to have their own section. I tend to focus most primarily as to when I have a group of people, I tend to know which area of my shelf I am heading towards, depending on who that group is.
No, yeah, so I think mine is kind of like a combination of both of yours to a certain degree. So I recently had to actually do this because I kind of moved things around. I'm actually moving fairly soon again, and I am dreading having to rearrange my collection once more.
To Cleveland, how nice of you. I'm
sure.
So excited.
I'm moving simultaneously to Ithaca and Cleveland. That's exactly what's going to happen. I'm not looking forward to the move. However, I have this game plan, which again is a combination of both of yours. So the first thing that I'm currently doing is that I do categorize it by genre of game. So I say Euro, deck builder, economic game, party game, worker placement game, etc., etc. And then after that classification, I go for a subclassification, which is going to be box size. So I start kind of arranging everything from left to right until that particular game genre is finished. However, The problem that I've had so far is that sometimes the box sizes vary wildly between these different genres. Like, for example, what am I going to do with Architects of the West Kingdom? It's a worker placement game, but it's like a quarter the size of a normal worker placement game. And what am I going to do with Paladins of the West Kingdom, for example? So there's different areas in the shelf that don't necessarily abide by this very rigid structure that I tend to kind of just use for the sake of visuals. And that starts changing things up a bit. But that I did have kind of like an inquiry. Do you have a preference between vertically stacking your games or horizontally stacking your games? And because I've also even seen people that do horizontally, then vertically, or just have some weird combination like that. Do you have a preference in your particular library?
Okay, I used to do horizontal until I realized that vertical, you can fit in more games if you, you know, store your games vertically. So the vast majority of my collection now is vertical, but I still do have some horizontal. So I'm storing like my big Lacerda and like Rococo Deluxe horizontally, just because I feel like vertically, I don't think it'll store that well. But you do end up saving a lot more space. But I still do have some horizontal ones as well.
Yeah, so for me, it's going to be a mix. I tend to do it. I like the visual aspect of mixing it up, of having some alternating, some cubbies horizontal, some cubbies vertical. But along with that mix, I tend to be very mindful of the fact that some games don't necessarily have the storage solutions that I want to be worth turning it on its side and have everything fall out. And so it's, for me, it's a combination of knowing what's in the box, knowing what I'm doing with it, and then just mixing it up for visual appeal or whatnot.
Do you also happen, I'm just coming up with all the questions about the shelves. I think I'm kind of researching, so when I have to again do this for like the fifth time this year, do you store big box games on your shelves, or do you have a separate storage location for those? Because I feel that they kind of always kind of break the flow of everything else that I have in my library.
If it fits in a cubby, it still goes in a cubby. If it doesn't fit in a cubby, I put it on the top.
Same. Yeah, if it fits in a cubby, I'll put it in one. But if not, then it goes on the top as well.
And so for anybody still here, kind of really paying attention to this burning questions about shelves, let us know about what your favorite type of organization patterns is. We even touched on it on the Facebook. But either way, until next week, everybody, this has been The Weekly Quack.